Hello and welcome to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. I'm Richard Moore and I'm with Lionel Burnham.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeman.
Hello, Richard.
This will be a podcast of two halves today. We're going to talk first about the latest doping news in cycling with Ryder Hesjedal, Michael Rasmussen.
The latest cycling news in doping.
It's hard to know. And then we'll end on a happier note with the Track Cycling World Cup, which you and I were at, Lionel. But where are we just now? Can you describe where we are?
We are in the Ravenscourt Arms in the St Pancras area of London. I've made a flying visit in from the Shires. To visit you two city
you
dwellers.
You literally come in your helicopter.
Not today. No. This is basically the first pub we could find.
That's relatively quiet.
Yeah.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
Well, Lionel, Daniel, it's been another eventful week. What have you made of the outing of Ryder Hesjedal by Michael Rasmussen? Michael Rasmussen has sort of dominated the cycling news for last week with his tell-all book, which is published today as we speak. He was on Danish television last night. He has named a lot of names, which a lot of writers haven't. You know, even writers who've published tell-all books, such as David Miller, have not named as many names, implicated as many other people as Michael Rasmussen has. And one of those people was Ryder Hesjedal, writes for Garmin Sharp, and of course won the Giro d'Italia in 2012. What was your reaction to that, Lionel? What are your thoughts?
Well, where to start?
Well, you put some of them on Twitter, of course,
well,
didn't you?
I did, but I was wrestling round and round with it because it's a complex issue, isn't it? I think if we were absolutely blunt about it, the revelation that a rider who rode in the early part of the 2000s had doped is not exactly the most stunning revelation, but it's the impact that has on how we must now view the 2012 Giro and Hesjedal's victory there, and also Garmin Sharp's policy, which has a lot of very positive things going for it. But I think a sort of loophole in the, you know, the thinking has not appeared quite so joined up perhaps this week in the way that they undoubtedly have made great strides forward in running a clean team in the moment.
I think they're, yeah.
It unfortunately is entirely relevant to, particularly when a rider wins the Giro d'Italia and the narrative is that you know, Ryder Hesjedal is winning the Giro d'Italia clean, which I don't think any of us really have any cause to doubt that he's clean in 2012 and clean when he's been with the Garmin Sharp team. But he won that race, and the narrative was not that he was an ex-doper winning that race. It was that this was proof that the clean policy of Jonathan Waters and the Garmin Sharp team can deliver a Grand Tour victory. And it was presented to the public.
And as you said last week, a crucial detail was left out of that narrative.
Yeah.
And it was followed a month or so later by the Tour de France, which Bradley Wiggins won, and was, you know, shrouded in suspicion the entire time. And that, looking back now, that seems, that could be an injustice.
It could be. I mean, that's the thing, that it's the juxtaposition of those two races and those two winners and the teams they ride for.
And the response
to their victories and how those victories have been seen, which absolutely, it's like the whole problem of doping in cycling in microcosm in that sort of 6 week period in the summer of 2012, because as I say, Ryder Hesjedal's backstory was that not that he was an ex-doper, that he was a clean rider, or there was no sort of suggestion that he had been involved, even though you could look back at his team history and look at Rabobank, Discovery Channel and Phonak and ask yourself the question. But there hadn't been anything to pin on him, and there was no point while he was winning the Giro, there was no point at which anyone was going to volunteer this information and say, actually, yeah, he's also a redeemed, reformed doper, and he's racing clean. Whereas Bradley Wiggins, some people may doubt this, but there is nothing to suggest that Bradley Wiggins has ever doped. It's entirely possible that he has come through the British cycling system clean. He's raced for French teams clean. He raced for Garmin clean, and now he won the Tour de France clean.
Interesting.
And so
if
that is the case, then an injustice was done.
Some of the suspicion, in inverted commas, around Bradley Wiggins was owed to the fact that previous people he'd worked with on previous teams, French teams, said this. You know, they didn't say this guy was doping when he was on our team. They said, I don't believe this guy was on our team could have made that kind of improvement. So there wasn't sort of historical suspicion there as far as we're concerned. Daniel, what were your thoughts on Ryder Hesjedal in last week's?
Just that it stuck in the throat, really. I think there's a disconnect, a discrepancy between perhaps what fans thought they were going to get from Garmin Sharp and Jonathan Waters, and what they, you know, that team has always advertised its transparency, and I think by transparency most fans will understand knowing everything and, you know, the team
full disclosure.
Full disclosure about the past, the present, the future. And what transpires to be the case is that, you know, that they're perhaps it's perhaps not relevant, or Jonathan Waters doesn't see it as relevant what happened 10 years ago when Ryder Hesjedal was a mountain biker, but fans want to know that. And let's not forget that fans are stakeholders in the team. Fans in the sense that fans are buying jerseys, fans are, you know, making multiple hour journeys to the roadside to watch them at the Tour de France, watch them at the Giro d'Italia. They're buying into the team and buying into the brand. Yeah. And I think Jonathan Waters, he claims to have known for years and years that Ryder Hesjedal doped 10 years ago. And I think he needs to give the fans that information. He needs to let them decide whether they want to continue to support the team.
Just to be to put the counterpoint, because there is a lot to commend Jonathan Waters and the Garmin Sharp team for, that if the goal is to clean up cycling and run a team that is clean, then he has done more than you would argue, you know, probably 90% of the other teams,
yeah,
to move in that direction. And his line that he insists that riders are absolutely 100% honest with the authorities is a very good sounding, it is a bit of a soundbite, unfortunately, because without the fans knowing what the backstory is at the time, there is the chance, the risk, that when it does come out, it backfires in the most unfortunate way for them. And that is basically what's happened this week. And it's very difficult to say, okay, at what point would Ryder Hesjedal have slipped this out and said it? It would have completely altered the perception of not only him as a rider, but the team and, you know, the Garmin Sharp policy. But unfortunately, that's happened anyway. So the only loser in all this, really, is cycling itself, because we've now got another Grand Tour where we thought we were watching one thing and actually we were watching something else.
I think there are two important sort of milestones in the history of Garmin Sharp. 2008, when they sort of entered the big time, rode their first Tour de France 2008, they had Paul Kimmage, the journalist, embedded with them. And I think Kimmage, who is an anti-doping journalist, or has been presented as an anti-doping journalist, gave them the stamp of approval. Now, there is a question, what did he know about what previous doping had gone? We know now from last year's reasoned decision that Christian van der Velde had been doping up to around about 18 months before that tour, where he was fighting for the podium. And there was a history of doping with other riders as well, and the manager, Jonathan Waters. Now, we weren't told that information at the time. There were a few people who were privileged to that and didn't share it. That was their decision. And I think a lot of us at the time would have taken a pragmatic view that cycling did of this history, that it was time to move on. But the ground has shifted a bit since then. And I think when the recent decision came out and we learned about Van der Velde, Zabriskie, Waters, Danielson, that was the time for full disclosure.
It was an opportunity, wasn't it?
That was the time for full disclosure. Those guys shielded from the explosion. Armstrong was the fall guy. The focus was all on Armstrong, and those guys were a bit protected by the fact that the focus was entirely on Armstrong, and they got off pretty lightly. Had Hesjedal been outed at that time, I think there would have been quite a negative reaction to that. But it wouldn't have been as bad as it is now. But that opportunity is gone. And I think also the narrative with the recent decision and the Armstrong story was that Armstrong was this bully, this guy who forced others to dope, imposed it on his team, etc. And some people were presented as victims, willingly or otherwise. And Hesjedal doesn't fit into that narrative, because his doping took place at a different time on a different team with other people. And I think that perhaps is a reason as well why that wasn't revealed at the time. You know, there's a closeness, there's a closeness, I think, between the US Anti-Doping Agency and some teams and individuals, and Jonathan Vaughters and Garmin Sharp, I would say that, not to read too much into that, but you know, there's a sort of closeness there that makes me a little bit uncomfortable.
Which they have earned by having an exemplary, at least present policy, and transparency about what's going on in the team currently and in the future. You know, they have earned that, you might call it, not complicit relationship, but a close relationship with the anti-doping.
As you said, you've made the point, Lionel, and you, Daniel. I think Jonathan Vaughters has done far more good than harm. I think he has been a force for good. That's not to say, however, that everything he's done has been beyond criticism.
This is a huge clanger. You know, Hazardar won the Giro last year, and as I've said already, you know, the story was presented in one way, and actually there was an incredibly important detail, particularly in light of the fact that that Giro win came, 4 or 5 months before the reasoned decision came out. And so, the one aspect I'm slightly uncomfortable with is this casting themselves as victims now, when they've harboured that information. They knew this when Hazardar was winning the Giro and didn't present it. And I understand entirely why they didn't present it. I understand the consequences of what would have happened had they presented it at that time. But nevertheless, it's no less satisfactory to find it out now.
This was pre-reasoned decision, of course. It would have been extraordinary to reveal it at the time. But I think the time was a few months later when the reasoned decision came out. And that, I think, we thought certainly at the time that what we were getting was a sort of form of full disclosure from...
Where the injustice falls is, and just to use another Garmin Sharp rider, is David Miller. David Miller served a 2-year ban and had to tread some pretty hard yards when he came back. When he won his first Grand Tour stage at the Vuelta, he made at his press conference, he said, He made a very strong anti-doping statement. He said he had won on bread and water, and that this proved that he could win without doping. And he did the same again in 2012, wasn't it, when he won his Tour stage?
Yeah.
So he went through hard years.
And
he wins those races as an ex-doper,
in the
context
absolutely.
Of an ex-doper. And Hazardar didn't win the Giro as an ex-doper.
You're right, you're absolutely right. And this is a point that's often forgotten, I think, about David Miller, that there now again history has been rewritten, that he was welcomed back. He wasn't welcomed back. He wasn't given a warm welcome at all, quite the opposite. And in some ways, ironically, perversely, he was lucky that Operation Puerto broke on the eve of his comeback tour, and somebody in the peloton who was willing to speak about doping was valuable, was rare at the time, and he was that man at that tour, and that maybe began the process of his rehabilitation, but there was nothing automatic about that at all.
This is the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Free.
So let's talk about the other character in this story, Michael Rasmussen, the chicken. He always was an interesting character, wasn't he, Daniel? I think you spent some time with him.
Yeah, he always gave the impression that he was very intelligent. I remember I spent a day with him in about 2005, I think the end of 2005, so... it was after his first very good Tour de France, and which ended with the disastrous time trial around which some of the mythology around Michael Rasmussen started to grow. I remember he fell four, maybe five times in that time trial, and then he was spotted riding back to his team hotel on them, lost on the auto route, wasn't he? I remember him talking that day when we met him he had a quite nice villa on the shores of Lake Garda, saying that he was very good at maths as a kid, and he certainly seemed an intelligent guy. He was so good at maths, in fact, that he'd calculated how much the dinner was going to cost, and he'd forgotten his wallet, so we ended up paying.
He calculated his hematocrit.
Yeah, but he...
calculated how many times he could crash in that plane trail.
I mean, he was a very... he was a very sort of nervous guy, but I think intelligent enough to be pragmatic, and we've learned this now, that he was very pragmatic about the doping. I mean, he makes no bones now about the fact that it was necessary. He's even said that he doesn't regret it, and he makes no bones about the extent of his doping as well, which I think has come as a shock to some people, just not just since he's released his book, but from what we've learned over the past couple of years, that he was really, you know, it was heavy artillery, wasn't it? It was blood transfusions, dynepo, epo.
There's a great little line today from the book where he was a teammate of Levi Lightheimer in 2004, and apparently at the tour that year, Lightheimer complained that they were only getting EPO, and how could they possibly be expected to compete with only EPO, which, again, sheds a light on just how bad things were at the time.
When you think back to that 2007 tour...
Well, we should explain the 2007 tour was Rasmussen's sort of big chance, wasn't
it? He came within days of winning it.
He did. I mean, and he was... It was such a bizarre sort of turn of events there. I remember being in Montpellier.
Yeah.
We were having dinner in Montpellier when we heard... out of the blue, he was in the yellow jersey, heard completely out of the blue that he had been expelled from the Danish team for the World Championships. This was a very strange announcement to be making mid-tour, that he wouldn't be picked for the Danish team for the Worlds. That was the first sign that something was up, wasn't it?
It was, but there was a story, wasn't there, that I think David Walsh had a significant hand in uncovering, which was that Rasmussen had asked a friend, a mountain biker friend, to transport a package from either from America to Europe or vice versa.
In a shoebox.
And he said it was new mountain bike shoes or whatever, and it turned out to be banned drugs. And then there was a whole thing about that summer about the whereabouts of riders, not only training in black colours so they couldn't be spotted by the anti-doping testers when they turned up for surprise tests, but also the story about Rasmussen. He declared that he was in Mexico, where his wife is from, and that he was in Mexico when actually he was training in, I think, the Dolomites, wasn't it, Daniel, in Italy. And the commentator for Rai and a former rider, Cassani, Davide Cassani, had seen him out training. And so this whole...
And mentioned this quite innocently in his commentary, didn't he? He was almost bigging him up, saying, oh yeah, he's been working really hard, I saw him training the Dolomites.
This sparked something with the UCI, that actually, no, he's declared that he was in Mexico then, and so everyone, they compared notes, and the facade began to crumble. And the extraordinary thing was the defence that the Rabobank team mounted of him.
Given what we know now,
but... Yeah, I mean, it was an extraordinary defence.
There was a press conference in Po, with the Rabobank lawyer in attendance. It was a very tense affair. We were used to Armstrong straight batting these questions.
In that very same press room in Po, that was the scene of the first face-off with David Walsh in 2001. David, good of you to make it, finally make it. And then six
that
years
was Lance
later,
Armstrong there, by the way.
And then 6 years later, there we were with... It was really that
it was an eventful day, wasn't it? Because that was also the day that we learned of Vinokourov.
Over a period of several days, Rasmussen was just disintegrating, and the cracks were appearing in his story. I remember he said that he'd changed his whereabouts information. He'd spoken to the UCI, he'd spoken to Ann Gripper, and a few resourceful journalists went straight back to their laptops and looked up the date of the start of Gripper's employment, and it turned out Ann Gripper wasn't even working for the UCI when Rasmussen claimed to have called her up, and it just felt like it was kind of tapering to a fairly unseemly conclusion, which is what happened. I mean, if you can ignore the doping, there were some fantastic duels between Contador and Rasmussen in that tour, but I think it's fairly indicative of what doping does to our watching experience, that people weren't really enjoying it, people weren't even really paying attention, because it all felt very inevitable that Rasmussen was a dead man walking, really. And Contador as well in that tour, I remember, I think he was only in yellow for 3 or 4 days when Rasmussen actually left, but Contador was coming under the same kind of pressure, because it was fairly soon after some damning allegations linking him with Operación Puerto, wasn't it?
Yeah, he was not impressive, as to be said.
It was from Montpellier onwards, wasn't it, that it ramped up.
Unraveled,
Rasmussen, never a noted time trialist. Daniel, you mentioned a couple of years previously barely being able to stay on his bike.
Yeah.
And yet, in Albi, he turned in a performance.
He finished 11th, I think.
Which, for him, was extraordinary. It was an extraordinary performance. And I was at their hotel that day. It was a campanile on the outskirts of Albi, right next to a blood transfusion centre, and the Astana team were sharing with Rasmussen, and it was almost like this perfect storm of all the tour stories converging on one mediocre hotel. but the, it was... Rasmussen would be, he was in the yellow jersey, wasn't he? And mm-hmm. So he would be laughed off.
Ticket
in
that team, didn't he? He won at team, and that was the day before a rest day. And yeah. it was on that rest day that he was asked about the shoebox.
He took it from Linus Gerdemund.
Yeah, that's right. And it started to gradually unravel from that point onwards.
That day in the Campania, we sat and had coffees and were working in the bar area, and the Rabobank riders came down, and everybody was there, the whole Rabobank team except Rasmussen, and Rasmussen came down as they were all going back up. Now that wasn't particularly unusual, because Rasmussen's start time in the time trial was probably, you know, might have been an hour later than everybody else, so he would have his breakfast a bit later. But it didn't do anything to dispel this feeling that he was sort of a bolt on to that team. Yeah, he wasn't a part of that team at all, really. And I'm no body language expert, but the way he kind of conducted himself and moved around and didn't meet anybody's eye contact, didn't really talk to anyone or engage with anyone, I just thought, this guy is going to win the Tour de France. And it didn't add up that he was the kind of personality type to win it.
And be a leader of a team.
Yeah, quite aside from the doping aspect. Mm. And yet when he got on his bike, and particularly in the mountains, he managed to hold it together.
Yeah, and he managed to hold it together. I mean, I remember vividly thinking in that tour that, you know, he was mentally disintegrating to the point where he wouldn't be able to perform on his bike. And on the contrary, the day before he was taken, or the stage before he was taken out of the race, that was where he actually, he really kind of wrapped up what would have been his tour victory, wasn't it? He dropped Contador on the Obisque.
Yeah, one at the top of there.
Yeah.
The same day, actually, that was the day that Moreni was frog marched off the mountain by the police. That was a final week of that tour where there were multiple doping stories every day, weren't there?
Yeah.
It was quite extraordinary.
And now we look back and, you know, the context of it and the things that Rasmussen is saying, and there doesn't seem to be an awful lot of... doesn't seem to be many denials coming forward, but it's worth pointing out that Rasmussen has claimed that all of the members of that 2007 Rabobank team were on doping of some kind. He didn't say EPO for everyone, but on doping of some kind. And of course, the Rabobank team doctor at the time was Geert Leenders, who was hired by Sky.
Yeah.
Which caused a lot of scrutiny for Sky during the 2012 tour.
Do we think this is going to be the nail in Bjarne Riis's coffin? There's talk of that. There's been talk of that over the weekend, that he's going to sell the team to Tinkov, and that will be the end of him, finally.
Yeah, although, I mean, there's certainly some incriminating stuff in Rasmussen's book about Riis, but there isn't a sort of bullet, a kind of...
Nothing.
He could potentially wriggle out of it once again. I mean, he knew about his doping, says Rasmussen, but he didn't help him with his doping, and that could be a crucial
Riis is Teflon coated. I mean, it will just deflect off him, and he'll just disappear.
I wonder whether Riis is finally, his appetite is finally sort of dwindled to the point where he doesn't particularly need to be in professional cycling, the manager of a professional cycling team anymore. I mean, I feel that his project has kind of run its course with, I think he probably knows that Contador is not going to win a Tour de France again. He no longer has this powerhouse of a team that he had with CSC, and that he was very much his identity was very much tied up with, and he doesn't have the financial means really to compete in the biggest races. So I just wonder whether this might be the time. He's a very wealthy man. This might be a good time to step away anyway.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the team, he's had to kind of get into bed with Oleg Tinkov, who is a loose cannon, and far too loose a cannon for Riis.
No one wants to be in bed with a loose cannon.
They certainly don't. What an image.
You're listening to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
All right, fellas, from the ridiculous to the sublime, at least as far as you and I are concerned, Lionel, Track Cycling World Cup in Manchester, we were up there. Mm. Daniel, did you catch any of the Track Cycling World Cup?
No,
you didn't watch any of them?
I've been to it before, I've been
Red
in the past. No, I didn't, I missed it. I was
I think you've been in a velodrome once, haven't you?
No, a few
more
times.
More than once.
But no, I've been to the Track World Cup a couple of times.
How did you feel about the coverage?
Could this be any more provocative?
I think it's fair to say, you're not a huge fan of track cycling. Is that fair to say?
I'm not a huge fan of the way it's evolved and the way it's become. It's so dominated by one country, and which obviously, well, One Nation, Great Britain, and just the huge gulf in resources between Great Britain, and it is not a competition, I don't feel, anymore. And, you know, I can see that from afar. I didn't follow it particularly closely. And I feel that some perspective is lost by perhaps particularly sports editors of mainstream media who don't really understand what Britain are achieving at the moment. And, and you know, how it's obviously, it's quite remarkable the success they've had, but it's not that remarkable when you consider the resources they've had. It's in line with the resources they've got. I think they should be, from what I can see, you know, they should be breaking world records at almost every meet. They should be winning, you know, dozens of medals almost.
I mean, actually, Germany were the dominant team this weekend. They won five gold medals, I believe. And they've been resurgent, especially in the sprint events. And, you know, the British men, actually, the men were seriously overshadowed this weekend by the women. I think you're right, Daniel, that, you know, excitement over, you know, frenzied excitement over the women's team, pursuit team, breaking the world record again is probably misplaced.
Because I mean, it seems to me, well, it reminds me of when they introduced the pole vault in track and field, and women's pole vault track and field. You had a sort of 2 years where Isinbayeva broke the world record almost every time she competed, and it's going to be the same with the women's pursuit team.
Although, what's worth pointing out is that the women's team pursuit team at the weekend there were within 0.2 of a second of the two of the men's teams from South Africa and China. And, you know, we spoke to Shane Sutton and Dave Brailsford on the final day of competition, and they said the target for them is to get 4.07 to 4.10. They think that team can get. That's pretty fast. That's pretty fast. And, you know, that's going to put them among the men. You know, I think what they're doing, they're in a league of their own. The streets ahead of the competition, but they are seriously fast, and they're well drilled, and they're good athletes. And for me, once again, the highlight of the weekend was Laura Trott. She is a proper bike racer. What's interesting about track racing is that there is, as far as I can see, total equality in men's and women's racing. As far as the crowd are concerned, certainly it doesn't matter if it's a woman or a man, you know, in GB kit, because it is clearly a very partisan crowd, as you'd expect. But Laura Trott is a proper bike racer, and she's electrifying to watch. In the scratch race, she took off on her own, gained a lap, as she had to do.
Took off on her own right at the start.
It was brilliant.
Yeah,
it took her 9 laps, you know, and it was awesome. And for the crowd to see close up another double Olympic champion riding like that, and what's so impressive about her is that she, you know, she is a major star on the back of the Olympics, as Olympians in this country are in the UK. She could have had her head turned. She could have pursued other opportunities. She could have gone the sort of down the showbiz route a wee bit, you know. But what strikes me about her is that she is as committed to her sport as she always has been. And she does remind me a bit of Mark Cavendish, actually, in the way that she rides and the joy that she gets out of racing, I think.
I think the biggest issue that track cycling faces at the moment is that, as Daniel says, it's become a one-nation event, particularly in terms of
what Germany, I mean,
in terms of and you look at where the events are held. I mean, the bottom line is they could have the three of the rounds of the World Cup in Manchester, Glasgow, and London and sell out every day, and choose any other velodrome in the world, perhaps bar Melbourne, and have tiny crowds. I mean, we've been to the World Championships when it was in Poland, hardly anybody there, even in Copenhagen. Not many people there, and that's the World Championships. And I think, going back to your point about the mainstream sports editors, one of the issues with the Track World Cup is that the BBC covers it, and so that automatically lends a kind of a lustre to it, that this is elite, the top of the top. And actually, the World Cup is just kind of the bread and butter. It's the World Championships where it gets really serious. But because it's on home soil, because the British team do so well, and because the BBC cover it, it is magnified in terms of its importance. And so that's why, you know, a picture will be on the front page of a newspaper when the Brits win a gold medal. But the problem is, if that dominance carries on, the public aren't going to get bored of it in Britain, are they? No. But the consequence could be that in another sort of sporting generation's time, so as this generation of British riders dominate, you know, where is the opposition going to come from? What's going to keep it fresh? What's going to keep it interesting? And also, in terms of the way that the disciplines have evolved, I think the Track World Cup programme now is an absolute shocker as a spectator. You go on, the format is always the same. So every Friday, it seems, it's always men's team pursuit, team pursuit, women's team pursuit, men's team sprint, women's team sprint. You're watching the same thing. And then over the weekend, you're watching both sets of Omniums, both Kierans and sprints. And for the, you know, if you're a casual fan going along, you want to see a bit of everything, not just the timed events one day and the sprint events on the other 2 days. And the UCI have got an awful lot of work to do to make this relevant going forward.
One obvious source of interest that I can see would be a really kind of bitter or intense rivalry between two British competitors, which I'm not sure we've really had in the last 10 years. I mean, we've had, you know, Pendleton Mears was a great kind of Australian-English or British battle, but I don't think that there have been anywhere that, I mean, it's such a centralised system, they train together, they live together, but that could potentially lend itself.
Froome-Wiggins style. Exactly, yeah. Rivalry, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in the 80s, with Coe Ovett and Steve Cram, you know, three of the best middle distance runners in the world, all being British. You're absolutely right. If there was a sort of narrative about this, but the problem with Chris Hoy when he was there was Chris Hoy, Jason Kenny, and it was kind of like the king and the prince. And they got on so well, and they shared the same birthday, and they, you know, there was no needle.
And I think that's because they shared the same birthday.
No, I don't think it is, but it's, you know, that they got on very well, and so there was no sort of guts to the story. And I think Daniel, you're absolutely right. If there was a, you know, I don't know, I mean, maybe they need some kind of
there was a little bit of needle a few years ago actually with Jason Queeley and Craig McLean. There was a sort of uneasy relationship there, but there probably wasn't the interest or the profile at the time to give that legs, that story.
I think when there was the battles to get into the team sprint squad, you know, that was always quite interesting, and there was, you know, trying to get four riders into a team of three. But really, the pursuits and it's so managed, isn't it? That's fantastic. But everybody's on a path to Rio now, and everyone kind of knows how that's going to evolve over the next 2.5 years.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, Lionel, because I spoke to one of the revelations of the weekend, Katie Archibald, who is quite a maverick, quite a punk-looking girl. She's got a pink hair, pierced lip, tattoos. She's really emerged over the last few weeks. She rode at the European Championships in the team pursuit team. They won gold medal. She rode for Scotland, Braveheart, at the weekend, and she won a silver medal in the scratch race, a bronze in the pursuit, and then rode very aggressively in the points race, but didn't get a medal. But you can see her strength. You know, she first rode the track the year of the London Olympics, which is staggering to realise. Or just, you know, the end of 2011, I think, was her very first time on the track. And she's now joining GB as a full-time member, and it'd be interesting to see how somebody like that, a bit of a maverick, self-confessed maverick, fits into that system. So I spoke to her after the points race at the Track World Cup.
The Cycling Podcast with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
So, Katie, your first World Cup, you go home with two medals. You must be an aggressive points racer. Are you disappointed with that one? But you must overall be very happy with the weekend.
Yeah, I suppose it's unfortunate you've got me about 20 minutes after that. And it's always kind of horrible to finish on a low, like, especially... I even finished the race on a low and everything. I completely messed up the last sprint and completely blown, trying to bridge the wrong gap, basically. I'm stuck in no man's land, and you can hit your head in public, but nobody's going to give you any sympathy. Learning experience, one of those ones.
You should have a lot to learn, because you only started racing very recently. I mean, you got on a track for the first time the year of the London Olympics. That really underlines how recent it was. When was it? I mean, can you describe your first time on the track? I think it was a Meadowbank, wasn't it?
I remember comparing the sensation to when you're on a... If you're on a boat overnight and you come off on dry land, you still feel like you're rocking back and forth. I remember lying in bed and still feeling like I was going around and around. just, like, never really gone that fast on a bike before. There's always been either a traffic light or a physical limit, and suddenly you just let loose, and it was fantastic.
So you, but what led to you? Because I know you'd ridden on the grass track with the Highland Games and so on for the year before. I think you started that. But what, you know, can you remember what led to you going to Meadowbank and trying out? Was it, did you sort of do your research and find that this facility was there? What inspired you to try it?
Well, the person that sold me my bike was I remember spoken about Alistair Watson, you know, and I think Alistair had sent me some training. Yeah, I'm fairly certain that the training came before the actual track, is that right? And he's either out saying to every person in the world, come and try the track, or he's got a good nose for sniffing people out. I've not seen too many failures of his, so...
And then you made rapid progress 2012. You came to the National Championships, you know, had a real breakthrough there, didn't you?
Well, most of the training that I did in the track, which was minimal, to be honest, was through at Meadowbank, but I'd say most of the experience I got was going around the hard tracks, like the big open concrete tracks, so places like Dudley and, let's say, Herne Hill. I think maybe I had a trip to Scunthorpe, those kind of places, doing a women's Omnium League. So that was my kind of preparation for nationals in September, junior nationals.
And then you must have watched the London Olympics in 2012, because you're very new to the sport, you come from a swimming background, but watching the London Olympics and Laura Trott and the like... I mean, was there any part of you that thought there was a possibility that within a couple of years you'd be teammates with these people?
Nah, there's no way. Because I think when you see people on the television, you're still in that fiction mode, and it seems like a whole different world. And you think that these are these superhumans that, to be honest, most of them have actually been doing it since they were eight. and quite a few of the stereotypes they fall perfectly into, that they've been risen to this from birth. But yeah, no, I think as it's become sort of closer in the horizon, can kind of understand and think this is an accessible world. It's not a birthright or anything, you can earn your way in. And it's just become closer and closer and more of a reality.
And now you stepped up at the Europeans, you slotted into that team, the Team Pursuit team, the Olympic champions, world champions, almost undefeated since the event was invented a few years ago. What was that like to slot into that team, and did you find it daunting? Were you intimidated at all?
Daunting, I think it's the right word. I wouldn't say intimidating, because we are all working together. I realise that we race against each other quite often, and that's that's a bit intimidating. But it was everyone's best interest to help me fit in, I suppose. There were occasions when it was quite apparent that I was on a development path, whereas they were on a kind of performance path, and they had to make exceptions and say, I'm still learning. I think Eleanor was doing a lap and a half turn at one point, which I was meant to follow with a half, and it's quite a stark contrast, really. I'm hoping that with the right amount of training, should be able to get up to that level.
Yeah, and you're now signed up to join the Great Britain team. I know you don't really know all the details for that yet, but presumably over the next days, weeks, you'll find out exactly what that entails. But you know, there's a chance. Dave Brills from Shane Sutton were talking about you this morning, that they look up now that they've got a squad of nine girls who could, you know, potentially be members of that Team Pursuit team. And I think that's your main target, isn't it, to be in the Team Pursuit reckoning?
Well, I think it's in their best interest to have a lot of people eager for a spot and aware that there's competition, and not just sitting around thinking that their place is safe. Likewise with the training, it's beneficial if you've got more people to slot in and out, and you're always going to have a big bunch to work together. It's really just to kind of give that breeding ground towards Rio and make sure that they have got the cream of the crop.
How did they accept you into the team? Because, as you say, a lot of those girls have been involved in the British setup for a long time now. How welcoming were they when you sort of became involved at the Europeans?
Brilliantly nice, actually. As I said before, there's no obligation for them to help you more than necessary, and there's no reason that they should put themselves out to help you. But all the girls were really understanding the fact that I hadn't been away before. I didn't know, if you can get your washing done. I don't know whether you can just take snacks and all these kind of the little things. But yeah, just the girls were really nice, and especially since we were racing as a team and not against each other, just made it that bit easier to come together and have a bit of a learn.
And, you weren't being drawn on the trash talk the other night with Jo Roussel, because you could obviously meet her at the Commonwealth Games, which has got to be another big target for you next year as well.
Yeah, I think she's got the pursuit set in her sights, rightly so. And yeah, got on really well with Jo, lovely. I was going to say lovely girl, it sounds quite brilliant woman. Just got so much respect for her that it's very hard to kind of build up the rivalry and talk her down.
You're going to have to do that.
Yeah.
Obviously, as your profile rises, a lot of talk about your hair, which I've been put right about today. It's not actually pink, it's tulip red, I believe. Do you think you could get fed up with people talking about your hair?
I can't really complain, can I? It's,
yeah.
It's, it'd be like, I don't know, writing something in your forehead and then being annoyed that people talk about it. It's something that I've always said.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because the Great Britain team has obviously an enormous reputation as a bit of a machine. You know, they're very clinical about what they do. You look like a bit of a maverick. How do you think you'll fit into that setup? Do you have any concerns about that? Or?
Well, I think when you look at it from the outside and when you see yourself, well, if you see yourself as an outsider, it's very easy to go, oh, well, there's no passion in that. And I love watching the Italians or the French and all this passion that they've got in their racing. But you're not going to turn around and say, no, Dave B, like, not going with your setup. I've got better plans.
How does cycling compare to swimming?
Well, yeah, you're saying I wouldn't trash talk about Joe, but I definitely do a lot of trash talking about swimming, to be honest.
Yeah,
like, I took it up when I was really, I think I was about 7 years old, and it was just that my brother was really good. I liked my brother. I thought, I'll give this a shot. And it was 200 breaststroke that I was best at. When I reflect on it, I can't understand why I was turning up to training, messing about, spending all these weekends racing. But
from the age of seven, did you say?
Was when I started training. I think that was maybe like three times a week when I was seven. It's not serious.
Do you wish you'd sort of discovered cycling earlier then?
Definitely.
Is that a regret?
Oh, huge regret. When you speak to the other girls, I think most of them have had maybe parents that cycle or there's just been something that's clicked when they've been younger. Because that's where I might have aerobically trained and have the kind of physical capacities to develop on, but the bunch race skills, I'm lagging about 5 years behind everyone at the moment. Like, I've really been bunch racing since I was 17. So I think it was at that age where you're still young enough to try stupid things, but old enough to understand and learn from them a lot quicker. So I've been trying to sort of make my progression double the rate of what your average 13-year-old's doing. And hoping that I've got the smarts to keep up.
Parents are fully supportive of this. I think your father's quite sporty, isn't he? He's a runner.
He used to be. He's had a couple of knee operations since then. My mum's fantastic for essentially, like, biggest fan. She'll call me up after that point race and tell me how amazingly I did. Just can't be helped. She'll tell me I look really good right now as well. And, well, podcast can't tell, but I'm sweating down the microphone anyway. fantastic.
So they're very supportive and fully supportive of you becoming a professional, joining the GB program.
Yeah, my dad tries to keep my feet in the ground, really. I think he's got a kind of dislike of people kidding themselves and prancing along with life thinking that you're going to be something big when you're not. I guess it's just lucky that I've got the two extremes with my mum and my dad, one trying to pull me down and one hopelessly pulling me up.
That's quite a good balance, probably.
Yeah, I've met somewhere in the middle.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. For more articles, go to humansinvent.com/cycling.
So, competition time. We've run our Mystery Voice competition the last 3 weeks, and we finally have a winner. Dominic O'Brien correctly guessed Kenny Van Hummel. A lot of people correctly guessed King Kenny in the end, but Dominic O'Brien was first. He did name a few names, to be fair. He named just about every Dutch cyclist that he could think of.
And some non-cyclists as well.
Probably. But he was first. Well done, Dominic O'Brien. It was Kenny Van Hummel. You win all three cycling anthologies, volumes 1, 2, and 3, a copy of Mountain Higher, which Daniel will post to you, signed.
Right, okay.
And, a calendar. The calendar you'll win as well, which I'm sure you'll enjoy. So we've now time for a new Mystery Voice competition. All you have to do is guess the voice.
But now...
So that was the Mystery Voice. It will be a bit longer clip will be played next week if nobody gets it. The competition is, if you could tweet at @HumansInvent, # Mystery Voice, and guess the owner of that voice. The prize for this first week is a copy of my Tour de France 100 book, Photographic History of the Tour, and we'll add to that each week as long as nobody correctly guesses. So please enter that competition.
But now...
And that's about all for this week, I think. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Richard.
Nearly called you Daniel there.
Thanks, Daniel.
Thanks, Rich. I'm off to watch some track cycling.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.